Good evening. At this time, he's missing in the TechNet on my mark. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and along with K2 KEY Mel. Well, we try to answer people's questions about ham radio. Kind of a complicated hobby. A lot more to it than first meets the eye. So, from time to time, people want to know how to make their antennas work better, how to make their transmitters work better, which one of the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio should they be using, which one's going to give them the most amount of pleasure. A person signs into Mel and Dick's TechNet by first giving us your call letters, your name, and then follow that with a yes or a no, which indicates that you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name.
Do we know which and yes?
Oh, but what a no. How are you doing, Dick?
W2OSR, yes.
W2BIE, no. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
WB7ABF, Rob, New York, yes.
KB1NNH, Jerry, no.
Okay, so far we've got Mel, Rich, man from Hop Hog that got covered up a little bit, Bob, BIE, Bob, and ABR. Let's see, WB7ABR, I think that was. And KB1NNH, I think it is. Did I miss anyone? Please give me a call letters and name.
KKND, Rich, and no.
You knew what I know, that.
K2JY, Steve, yes.
Okay. Steve with a yes. KNB, no so far, but you just wait and see. Our president's going to have a question. And I think there was another person I missed who was a double.
Yeah. WN2, VUU, Whiskey November 2, Victor United, United France over here in Bohemia with a no, Dick.
Okay, we got you, Frank. Good strong signal from Bohemia. Okay, I think we have more than enough to get started. Let's start up with Rich first. N2EO, what's happening in Whitestone, Rich? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick and Mel. N2EO, Whitestone, Queens. Dick, first of all, you give me yes or no when I turn it back to you and Mel. I emailed you guys a little something. I hope you got it okay. Just wanted to throw something out, see if anybody has any comments. About 20 years ago, I had a tower on the roof, took it down, you know, typical that time, Rome 25 roof tower, took it down, it was a bad decision. Anyway, I ordered a Glenn Martin 9-foot tower. Call it a tripod, I guess you call it a quadpod. It's got four legs to go on the peak of the roof. And I ordered a AM4 rotor. Fortunately, I've got somebody who's worked for me who's going to be putting it up. Just wanted to find out if anybody had any problems or suggestions. Also, I'm on a fairly tight property about 30 feet wide, and your average tri-band or like a TA-33 is going to go over the neighbor's property about a foot in either direction when it's turned a particular way. I'm thinking possibly of a Cubex quad as opposed to a Mosley TA-33, which has a very short turning radius, or this OptiBeam from Germany, which has a very tight turning radius. What if anybody has any suggestions on that, or using the Glenn Martin Tower on a peak roof? Any suggestions? I'd appreciate it. And 2EO, back to that.
Smile, give me
you some pointers about mounting one, if that's what you're looking about, how to go about securing it, if that's what you're looking for, Rich, over.
Yeah, considering the fact he's going to be putting up a pretty massive antenna, I hope you're going to be suggesting that the he has some backup boards underneath the rafters, that the screw from the quadrupod, the Glenn Martin, not simply go into the roof, but be a kind of a or a carriage bolt or something like that that goes through the roof into a 2x4 or a 4x4 or a 2x8 that's behind the rafters and makes kind of a sandwich. I wonder if you've done anything along those lines, Mel. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, Dick, he gives you suggestions. He gives you the carpentry layout in the attic. That's required, so that's going to be done.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, that's what I was going to say, if they give you a good mounting suggestion. The best thing I could advise you is that, of course, proper mounting of it, yes, of course, is the number one criteria. But, of course, also, you don't want any water to be sneaking in through any of those mounting bolts that are going to have to go through the roof. And especially if they're going to go through the joint, the possibility is going to drill through some of those support joints. So you got to be careful. No moisture gets in there and starts rotting anything inside the attic area. So preparation of installation of usually some kind of, you know, these mastic caulking. They got some of this new type of material that you can put down, that, you know, these membrane, which makes it self-sealed. Basically, this membrane is used now on most of the roofs. You see it, it's a self-sealed, that any kind of screw, nail, anything goes through it, it seals and doesn't let any moisture go through there. Because, number one, the moisture, of course, gets through there, not only will it rot, start rotting, you know, rafters in the attic, but also, if possible, you know, you want to make sure that it doesn't start building up any kind of rust or corrosion around the, you know, the supporting bolt. So I figure you want this thing up there a lot of years. So it's really got to be, you know, really secured correctly, but also, you know, protect the property. I don't think your parents, you can believe it, your father would be there. I don't think he'd want to see any dripping, Rich, over.
Yeah, if I know Rich, though, Barry N2MB is going to be involved in this installation. And Barry has a lot of experience with pretty big antenna arrays and tall towers and whatever, and how to hook things up in such a way they're going to work. So with Barry's help, I don't think you're going to have much of a problem. It does sound like you're putting up a rather large beam, having a lot of moment of inertia, and length and wind load, the cubic quad, the optic beam, or any of these antennas, reasonably good in size. And as such, do consider making something that's beyond what the manufacturer recommends, and that's my suggestion with reference to wind balancing. Many a Yagi, particularly more with 6-man-3 elements, usually has more boom out in front of the mast than behind the mast. Therefore, the antenna tends to be a kind of a reverse weather vane, so to speak. It wants to aim itself downwind. And so a vertical sheet of metal mounted near the reflector, behind the reflector, perpendicular to the ground, of the right size, can make an antenna zero on the wind balancing. In other words, if the wind blows from the side and the antenna doesn't tend to turn downwind or upwind, you've succeeded, in my opinion. That can make a huge difference in not only the amount of twisting it does on a windy day and rocking back and forth, creating a QSB, but it can also make a huge difference in survival of the rotator, survival of the hardware that connects the mast and the boom together, and maybe even how much stress is put on those bolts that go into the roof, and ultimately how well it holds onto the roof and how well it stays weatherproof. So wind balancing, in my opinion, can buy an awful lot. The biggest antenna I ever built, which was a little bit less than 5,000 cubic feet of antenna, mounted at the 100-foot level of a tower. I'm talking about 16 Yagis, each 13 feet long, all with 5.5-foot spacing. So this antenna I'm describing was 17 feet wide, 16 feet high, and 13 feet deep, all mounted 100 feet in the air. A lot of stuff. And in the beginning, I turned that with a chintzy little AR-22 rotator because it was wind balanced, and it worked. And eventually I put in a ham M just to be sure, and so that I would have a finer readout as far as the antenna aiming is concerned. So wind balancing can do an awful lot. Now, if anyone has familiarity with the Glenn Martin quadrupod, the Cubex quad antenna, the OptiBeam antenna, or any of the other possible pieces of hardware you think Rich is going to put up, if you have any personal experiences or even indirect information that you think might help Rich, please give us your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, sir.
Stand by 1 second.
We're standing by.
Okay, all right, I'm back. Yeah, good evening, Dick. Everyone else? I happen to have that particular quad pod installed on my garage. I installed it 2 years ago. And the only way that I would do an installation like that, which I did, was to install in the attic of my garage 2x4s across the beams in the garage and drilled into the 2x4s, or drilled through the 2x4s, I should say, are carriage bolts that go through the roof. The tripod is mounted right on top of the shingles with carriage bolts, one per leg, and there's four legs, and going right through the 2x4s that have been installed across the beams. I got four of those, and this thing is so sturdy, the roof will collapse before the tripod does. That's the insulation that I did, and then I sealed everything up with flashing cement over the tripod. And I've had that up for 2 years, no problems at all. Get back to you, Dick.
KY, another comment.
Mel recognized, but before we go there, Rich, how big an antenna did you put on your quadrupod?
Right now I did not. There's no antenna on it. But any antenna that I want to put on, it'll hold it without any trouble at all.
Very good. Mel, go right ahead.
All right. I got one of those quadrupods, never used it, playing in the garage, brand new, in fact. And somebody gave it to me. They were going to put it up on the roof and never used it, and they were moving, so said if you want to take it, so of course one of my just reviewed it for nothing. And I looked at it, and I see the way those legs sit. If you go ahead and let the bolt that right down onto the shingle and the start tightening up on it, pulling up on it on the other side, especially if you reinforce across the rafters with the 2x4, you're going to start to indent into that shingle. You're going to start biting through that shingle. Definitely, it's going to work its way through and loosen up in the process, the bolt. So I would suggest, I don't know, I haven't looked at the instructions, but I'm sure that I bet you they suggest that you put down some pressure-treated lumber first. Take the shingles off where it's going to go. Put pressure-treated lumber, secure it right down there with one of those, like I say, that waterproof self-stick membrane. Put the shingles back all around it with flashing, and do not, I don't think, lay it directly on the just over the shingles like that, because I think those legs will, from what I see, will eat through the shingles, Dick, over.
John, good selection suggestion. Now, I also put a large quadrupod on top of the roof of my house, at the peak of the roof, and in my case, it was supporting a 10-foot diameter satellite dish that could be steered in various azimuth and elevation directions. And to make sure that the legs didn't dig through the tar of the shingles of the roof, I laid down, I think it was 2x6s, two strips of 2x6, each strip picking up two legs each. So in other words, the 2x6, in my case, sat directly on top of the shingles. The quadruped legs sat on top of the 2x6, and that way the legs were biting into pressure-treated, CCA-treated 2x6 and not into the roof. Carriage bolts that went through those 2x6s and or the legs of the quadruped into a 2x4, again in my case, behind the rafters. So as you snugged up on the bolt for the carriage bolt that went through the 2x6 above the shingle, through the roof, into the 2x4, behind the rafters, it made a kind of a sandwich. And therefore, it made one complete assembly between a number of parallel rafters and the quadruped. That worked extremely well. Very, very sturdy assembly. My only complaint, in my case, was that it was so sturdy that the gear sound of the motor that moved the 10-foot diameter satellite receiving dish, this was back in 1985 when I did this, the gear sounds were so clearly transmitted through the quadruped into the roof and into the house. So you would hear this grinding sound, which was not at all alarming once you knew what it was, but the sound of the actuator that moved the dish was extremely well coupled through that assembly into the house, and you heard it very well. And I think that's it's a left-handed compliment when you hear that. I can't think of any good way of making the assembly very sturdy and simultaneously soundproof. I'm sure there's ways of mounting some kind of a very sturdy shock absorber in the right place. I didn't worry about that at the time. And that whole assembly worked very well. So with some of these ideas, Rich, and with the help that I think you're going to have from Barry, I think you're not going to have any trouble. Roughly how many feet long, and by the way, I did get that mailing, and I thank you. How many feet long was the is the boom or the wind loading of the antennas you're going to put on top? And 2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, I know
what
TA-33 is about 4.5 square feet. And I think the other antennas are about equal. Yeah, the guy putting up, Barry may help me actually get the antenna up to the tower. But the guy putting up the tower is a local contractor here. I mentioned him on the TechNet before. He's done a lot of work for me. He does good work. He's very responsible. He's some of Ken Sullivan. He sort of runs a small contracting business here in Whitestone. He puts the table up for me. He shelves up. He did a lot of carpentry for me. So what I did was I contacted him. He's internet savvy, and I had him go to the website because they give you instructions on the website. And I said, can you do this? He said, yes. What you're talking about now, that membrane, he mentioned, this fellow mentioned the same thing. He said that's what they use. It's the latest thing for sealing. He said I won't get any leaks that way. What I'm going to discuss with him is what you said, Dick. Because you see, Glenn Martin gives you on his website copy of the instructions, which is the carpentry in the attic, like you were saying. But he supplies you with lag bolts. Two lag bolts per leg, totaling 8 lag bolts. And he controls the sensors right down on the existing shingle and go right through. So maybe I'll talk to Glenn Martin, because I was worried about that myself, and then possibly do what you did, Dick, back to that and to Leo.
Very fine, Mitch. Good luck with that operation. Let us know how it goes. Next person on the list, I think, is Bob, W2OSR, our secretary. And what would you like to discuss tonight, Bob, K2RIW in the TechNet? Possibly Bob was just checking in, and I thought he was getting on the question list. Lou is the next person, W2BIE, but Lou I think said he didn't have a question, but I'll give him an opportunity. Lou, you did or didn't have a question?
No, I didn't, but I listened to everything. Thank you, Dick. Have a good week.
Okay. That guy Lou is always listening. He doesn't miss a trick. All righty. The next person, I think, was Bob, WB7ABR. I didn't write down a yes or a no, so you have an opportunity to ask a question if you want to, Bob. You got it, sir.
Bob, Rob, fine. WB7ABF, Manhattan, good evening, gentlemen. Always a pleasure to listen to this net. And if you recall, a few months ago, I mentioned that I had an OCF, a dipole on my roof here in Manhattan, doing well with it, using twin leads, now I'm using 450 ladder lines, running HF, et cetera, et cetera. My question is twofold. It's probably a very generic question. One, balance. Yes or no? Do you really need them? And more importantly for me, TBI. I haven't had any problems, but recently, a couple times, a kind guy from another floor in the apartment building who claims to be a film editor said, I'm getting all kinds of weird noises in my computer, and I'm a film editor, and I got to do this stuff between the morning. And I said, oh, gee, well, that's very interesting. You know, I'm in music and ham radio, and, you know, try not to get too involved. Printing it must be ARRL's what to do if you have electronic interference problems. She gave it to the guy, and access to a website that has MP3 samples of what noises sound like. Pretty convinced that it's not my station just causing the problem. Question is then, basically, TBI in an apartment building setting. I have a low-pass filter. I've never had any problems before. I don't think consumer electronics are all that great nowadays. What's a good approach for this kind of a thing? So I hope this isn't too off the mark. WB7ABF, listening back then.
Not off the mark at all, Rob. No, these are very appropriate questions. First of all, a balun is a device which takes your unbalanced coax cable. By unbalanced, I mean if everything's working just right, all of the signal that you and I care about is on the semiconductor and between the semiconductor and the inside surface of the outer shield of the cable. And there should be no signal on the outside of that cable. That's the way coax is supposed to be used. And the balancing device will take that unbalanced signal and make it act on the other side of the balun like it's a kind of a twin lead. And a dipole-like antenna, a fully balanced antenna, at one instant of time, your transmitter is trying to drive the right-hand side of the dipole with positive voltage and the left-hand side of the dipole with negative voltage. And if you just simply hook the coax cable to the dipole, you can put the shield to the right side and the semiconductor to the left side, and the dipole itself will take that unbalanced signal out of the coax, try to balance it, that's just the way the dipole works, and it's going to end up feeding some signals back down the outside of the shield of the coax cable. So the dipole itself will be feeding signal down the outside of the cable if you don't use the balance. In most cases, that's not serious. It is a Cadillac approach, though, to use a balance because it sort of guarantees you're going to have a drastically decreased amount of signal flowing down the outside of the cable. The signal that does flow down the outside of the cable can aggravate television interference. If your cable happens to run by the neighbor's apartment and maybe near his set or near his antenna, it can couple some extra signal into his antenna. Second of all, in the worst case, you can sometimes get so much RF energy crawling down the outside of the cable that you've got the condition they call RF in the shack, or if you were using a D104 mic, as you bring the microphone up to your lips and your lips touch the mic, you'll hear a little spark jump between the microphone and your lip. That's an extreme case. So it's a good idea to use a balun, but it's not a showstopper if you don't do it. Now, when it comes to TBI, thank goodness the majority of television watchers these days are using cable TV, and cable TV, if it's properly installed, is a very well-shielded system, and therefore very little from the outside world can get to it. Where you're using a low-pass filter, it strongly guarantees that you're not going to have any significant amount of harmonic energy coming out of your transmitter. If, for instance, you're on the 10-meter band at 28 megs, the second harmonic is 46 megs, very close to the IF frequency of the television set, and so your second harmonic of your 10-meter rig or the fourth harmonic of your 20-meter rig can definitely aggravate the neighbor's television set, and a low-pass filter will essentially eliminate that. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you get modern-day equipment that is inexpensively made with a tissue paper front end, as they say, not very much dynamic range or high intercept point to the front end, all of it will say a television set, you could get simple RF overload, even though 99.99% of your energy is on the ham band only, 14 megacycles, 28 megacycles, 21 megacycles only, and therefore the television set tuned to 56 megacycles for channel 2 should have no response. Well, if the signal is strong enough, every television set, every radio has a point of overload. A poorly designed one overloads at a very weak signal. A well-designed one takes a very strong signal to overload. But if your antenna is at some somewhat small distance, less than an eighth of a mile in some cases for a very, very delicate set, if your antenna is relatively close to his aerial and his electronics, the magnitude of the RF getting to his electronics creating RF overload, even though you're perfectly legal on the right frequency, his set can show a response to it. And now you're in a tricky situation. Morally, you're sort of obliged to try to help him out. Legally, you don't have to. If the FCC did a thorough investigation of your situation, they would say you're transmitting exactly where you're supposed to, what your license allows you to do, and because he has a poor quality set, he's getting interference. Trying to explain that to a neighbor sometimes can be extremely difficult, particularly if it gets to the escalated point where the neighbor has brought it to the local zoning board, and before the zoning board he's screaming and hollering that if I didn't have that ham radio operator moving next door to me, I wouldn't have this problem. Well, if there weren't burglars in the world, I'd never be burglarized. You have to be realistic here. He has to learn to comply, and until he does, it is a good idea, in my opinion, to try to help the guy out. Now, help the guy out. In the very beginning, you find out what is his favorite television watching program, or in the case of the man who is composing programs, what is the hours in which he works. You can volunteer. You don't have to. You can volunteer to not operate during those hours during the beginning of the curative process. You and he are trying to find a solution to this problem, and until you find a solution, a really smart amateur radio operator will volunteer to not operate during the Super Bowl, not operate during the person's favorite soap opera or whatever. And you ask him what hour he's on, and you'll stay off during those particular hours. When it comes to the more permanent solution, a high-pass filter on his television set can go a long way toward eliminating television interference. And the high-pass filter, there's two or three different ways you can get one of those. You can just write a check and make the problem go away and buy a good brand of high-pass filter, and I think even Radio Shack sells one. A slightly more economic solution to that is to realize that essentially every television manufacturer will supply a high-pass filter free of charge on request. If the person who bought the television set goes back to his manufacturer and makes the request that, hey, you were given permission by the FCC to leave out that high-pass filter because it's not needed all the time, but they will supply it free of charge on request. So that way you can get the high-pass filter. But to wait and go through the rigmarole of getting it through the manufacturer, particularly if the person has had the set for 10 years, that can be somewhat troublesome. I'd rather have the problem go away as soon as possible, and even if it costs me $4.50 to buy the high-pass filter from Radio Shack, I'm not sure what the price is, in order to keep peace in the neighborhood, I'd be willing to do that. Because although it sounds at first unfair that you should have to pay to correct the deficiency of his set, if you listen to the horror stories that have occurred where the amateur was non-compliant and the neighbor was angry and it got escalated to the point of people calling the police, calling into the zoning board, and doing all kinds of crazy things like that, when it escalates to that point, it is very difficult to recover the situation. You could end up being an enemy of that particular neighbor for the rest of the life of the time that he lived there, and that's not the way it should be. So try to keep everything friendly is my strongest opinion, because it ain't fair, but We're the people that have to ride the back of the bus, so to speak. At least in the old days we did. We're the underdogs. We're the rare animals. There's only one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. So we are the oddballs. And from my point of view, we should try to keep peace in the neighborhood. Because if that neighbor then starts gathering the resources of all of his fellow neighbors, and he decides to make a posse, if you know what I mean, and really escalate this thing, it can get quite out of hand. I, as a person who has appeared on about 12 or 13 occasions before zoning boards defending radio amateurs, I can tell you that it can become a range war. And some of these range wars almost get to the point of physical violence. It shouldn't go that far. I'm probably being extreme, but I'm just giving you an idea of what could possibly happen, Rob. WB7ABF, K2RIW. I hope I got your call that is correct.
Yeah, K2RIW, WB7 Alpha Victor Fox. Very good, Dick. A very good point, very salient point. And really, those are my feelings as well. You know, rather than err on the side of non-involvement, I tend to err on the side of friendliness. Let me just clarify a couple things. The fellow is a film editor, so he's editing movies on video. So not even a matter of TV. Prefacing this, I'll mention half the neighbors in this neighborhood, and it's not a great neighborhood, all have cable TV, so we're spared all of the outdoor aerials. That's not really a big problem. Those problems back in Seattle, believe me. This guy's a film editor, so he's been working at 2 in the morning and just saw the ham antenna on the roof, the old dipole, what he was doing on the roof, I don't know, but, and of course, ham radio operator equals trouble. He's only come a couple times, it's been nice, but again, he's not technically oriented at all. So one has to be kind of gingerly and nice. And I, like I say, volunteered, well, here's this webpage from the ARRL, and here are some WAV files and MP3s of what interference sound like. I can almost assure you that what he's picking up is probably produced by other electronics in the building, whether it's electric blankets, blenders, you name it, because I even hear some of that stuff. You know, I hear the neighbor's TV monitor coming in through my HF rig, you know. So that's something I will then try to deal with. And I will approach him again and offer to help, you know, whether it's with Toroid beads or whatnot. But again, just to clarify, I run low power. Rarely do we go over 100 watts. We're not talking Yagis here. We're talking a QRP CW operation. And this is a recent phenomenon. You know, I'll probably be here another year, but this is the first time I've actually gotten a legit complaint from anyone. So the guy probably had had some contact with the amateur radio or CB before and immediately assumed, like you stated, this was one of his oddballs. So I'll deal with it that way. In terms of the information on the Ballon, I will investigate that. And again, I'm running a 450 ohm line to my antenna, and it does quite well. I don't want to burden you guys with more questions, but again, here's a fellow who's living on the seventh floor of an apartment building. You know, I have no true ground, per se, and I don't really use any, nor do I use counterpoises. I am literally hooking up my antenna as a counterpoise to the radiators in the building at times. And it even gets out on 160, but I don't even use counterpoise wires as a fake ground or RF ground. So when there's a lightning storm, I just disconnect everything. Sad unintended passing. In any case, if you guys get back to the net, I'll be listening in, and I appreciate the comments on the sage advice, Dick, and your experience in the area. WB7ABF, back to you.
MCO was suggested.
Rich recognized, and a second person recognized. Get to both of you in a minute. One other thing I want to mention. Alpha Victor Foxtrot, I'm trying to get it right, Rob, and that is, even though he's doing film editing, it's a piece of electronics, and it's a piece of electronics that was maybe not built to operate near strong RF fields. The television set, hopefully the manufacturer does some bypassing of the 110-volt line that comes into it, and things like that, whereas the film editor machine doesn't anticipate that. Every piece of wire that touches your electronics, whether it be the wire that goes from your keyboard or your mouse to the computer, or in this case, the 110-volt plug that goes into the socket in the wall. Every piece of wire is potentially an antenna picking up signals and coupling it into the electronics. So there are various kinds of filters that you can put in his wire itself that goes to the plug in the wall. There are things you can... clamshell-like things that you can clamp onto it, which act as an RF attenuator, an RF shield, a choke. Even a large toroid with the cable wound through it a few times and plugged in the wall can make a huge improvement. There are other kinds of devices that have a bypass capacitors built into them. So even though he doesn't have an antenna connected to his film editor, consider the possibility that his electronics are still picking it up. Even though you believe it is other things in the building, and you're probably right, to be double darn sure, do make suggestions to him of ways of stopping his line cord from being an antenna. I'll see what Rich had to say. M2EO, go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I was going to suggest that he ask the gentleman what time he does the film editing, and go up there so we can supposedly listen to this interference, and hopefully it'll come on, and then he can say to the guy, look, it's not me. I'm up here with you. How can it be me? And if he wants to be super friendly while he's waiting for this interference to come on, he can come bring up his Kentucky Fried Chicken or pizza and be friendly guy. It's easier to be friendly guy, like you said, than to get into an argument.
Yeah, and if you really trust the person, this is a risky area I'm about to enter here, but if you really trust the guy, that you've got a good relationship with him, and he's not going to be a hothead immediately, with your pair of handy talkies, you can have your wife or someone else turn on your rig while you're in his apartment watching his piece of electronics. And you can talk back and forth with the handy talkie from his apartment to your apartment, and therefore, when the wife turns on the rig to your normal frequency, you can see whether or not there is anything appearing on his particular piece of electronics. As I said, that's a slightly risky one. Go slow, but if you think you can really trust the guy, and if you want the absolute truth of the situation, that's a possible way to go. Was there another person who made a suggestion? If so, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And this is K2KEY. Basically, I was going to say that go over if the person is congenial enough to go to his apartment, take your cell phone with you, and call on the phone, dial back down to your apartment and have somebody key the rig and see if it has any kind of effect on his system. Also, if you're using 450-ohm ladder line and you put it into a good balanced input on a tuner, the tuner will also enhance the reduction of any kind of harmonics. Find that number of places I suggested of using a tuner, a good tuner like with a rotary inductor and all, and it does help to eliminate the problem of harmonics to some extent besides the low pass filter, Dick, over.
Sorry about that. Some more good suggestions. Anyone else want to add to this before we go on to the next person? Give me a call letters right now. Okay. Rob, please come back and let us know how it turns out, whether it turns out well or not so well. Please come back and let us know. The next person who signed in that I'm not sure could have been a real questioner, our president, Mr. K2KNB. Rich, did you say you had a question? Because I didn't write down a yes or no, and I should have. Over to you, Rich, if you're there.
Yes, Dick, I'm here. No, I didn't have a question, but I did want to just kind of tell you over the air that we are making arrangements, perhaps as early as next week, to have you broadcast through a Echolink conference station, which is being donated to us. Time will be donated to us, full 4 hours or whatever it takes, and we'll give you more information, but we know that to that particular conference server, you can have 1,000 people sign in, so we should be able to get some good feedback on who's out there and who's listening, and we think it's going to be a lot of people. So I'll let you know about that, but I wanted to let everyone else know that we will give you more information, but starting next week, we should have you up on a Echolink conference call. Back to you, Nick.
That's good. Sounds like Rich, Eric, and Andy have been busy. The system is getting bigger, more elaborate. It's going to have more horns and whistles. Look out. Okay, the next person who signed in, who I think had a real question, was Steve, K2JY, if I can read my own writing. Steve, go right ahead. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, this is K2JY. Thanks, Dick, and good evening to everyone. My question is a CW question. I do a lot of mostly CW operation, mostly down on 40 meters, and mostly QRP. I listen a lot also, and a lot of times I'll listen to guys start to, contact, and they'll be slightly off frequency. But every once in a while, I'll listen, and one guy will be exactly spot on, dead on frequency with the other guy, to the point where, you can't tell the difference between one and the other. So my question is, how do you do that? Is there a trick? Is there something that I've missed? How do you, is it zero beat one guy with the other? So you're exactly on the same frequency as the other guy? Dick, over.
I can answer that, Dick.
Okay. I've got some suggestions. I'll bet you Mel has suggestions, but Rich spoke up first. Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, some of the rigs have a spotting feature. I don't know about the Japanese rigs, but the Tentec rigs, like what I have here, a Tentec Y2, has a spot button spot, S-P-O-T. It's similar to the old spot of the 60s, but a little different. What you do is you press the button, and you hear the side tone, your side tone, that you would normally be sending, but it's side tone without actually putting it over the air. And what you do is you tune the radio to match the other person's signal to the side tone coming out of the radio, and you're dead on. For instance, I like a low frequency. I keep the spot at around 400 hertz, so when I dial the CFO to the signal coming in is also 400 hertz, then I'm right on the button. Back to that.
Yeah, that spotting function sounds like a beautiful way to make sure you're on the right frequency of the guy that you're listening to. And it's going to work like a charm for a person who is not tone deaf. But there are some people who are tone deaf. And to try to tune the receiver so that the signal you're listening to produces a tone of the exact same pitch as your side tone function of your receiver, for a person who's tone deaf, that's going to be a little bit difficult. The best you can do is to recognize all of the things that can create a miss frequency on return, an inaccurate frequency on return. The tunable IF, in some cases, can adjust it. The receiver incremental tuning can adjust it. In some rigs, a guy might listen to the CW in the upper sideband mode and then go over to CW mode in order to transmit back. On many a rig, you'll notice that if you flip back and forth between the CW mode of reception and the upper sideband mode of reception, you'll hear a different pitch. And if the guy who designed the rig did a real good job, he recognizes the fact that you kind of zero beat the signal for sideband reception, but you want a particular tone that's pleasing, like 600 hertz or 1KC, when you're listening to Morse code. So the rig does a kind of an offset between transmit and receive function in the CW mode. The next big problem, of course, is that even if the rig was set up properly, and if it doesn't have the spotting function that Rich is mentioning, you've got the problem of some guys intentionally tune Morse code that sounds most pleasing to them at a very low pitch or a very high pitch. I'm one of the low fellows. In other words, I like listening to an extremely weak signal at about 500 hertz, 400 hertz. To me, it gives me the best signal-to-noise ratio in my hearing. But there's an amazing number of hams out there who get the most amount of signal-to-noise ratio at a 1KC or 1.5KC. So without the spotting function, each one of us would be tuning to a different offset between transmit and receive. About the best you could do is to have somebody listening over the telephone play it back to you. You got a buddy that lives a mile away, and you and he both listen to the exact same station. Then you do a transmission until your buddy on the telephone hears the exact same tone, and now you know how to tune your rig. you may recognize, even if you don't have a spotting function, that if your particular rig in the CW mode requires a 600 hertz offset in that 600 hertz tone in the receiver in order to make the transmission come out on the right same frequency, that's one way to do it. Another thing to worry about a little bit is that some rigs, the frequencies may be exactly right, but when you go into the transmit mode, the power supply drops a little bit in voltage. Depending how good the voltage regulator is, you may end up on a slightly different frequency that you really transmit on. That's the reason why I'm suggesting the telephone experiment. So one other thing worth considering here is the fact that it doesn't have to be perfect. Human beings are extremely adaptive, as I see it, Steve, so that there's a slight advantage in people in a round table being extremely slightly offset in frequency. You know, when one guy ends and another guy starts, a really good operator can recognize the difference in the fist. My favorite buddy I used to work Morse code with, as soon as he sent about four letters, I'd say, uh-huh, I recognize that particular swing. That's my buddy Rob, who used to be K2RJB. And he had a particular swing. He and I taught each other Morse code, and I could recognize his fist anywhere, I thought. Maybe I was wrong, but I thought so. So a slight offset is not so bad. Of course, it can get a little bit troublesome if you're in a very crowded band and somebody is offset to a place where he's on top of the next adjacent communication. Good luck with your Morse code, and let us know how this all works out, Steve. K2JY, K2RIW in the deck man.
K2KY, I'll tell you what to do.
Uh-huh. Stand by, Steve.
Steve Rubin, joining.
Okay. We're gonna get at least two more answers here, Steve. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Being a very avid CW operator, what I have a gadget, basically, that I built, and it's got three LEDs. The middle LED, the red one, you adjust that, first of all, put a brightness. You'll see it begin to flicker, and as you come to the center frequency, it will turn bright. What you do now, if you're running split, of course you're running transceive, that's one thing. I usually run with a separate receiver and a transmitter, the VCS line. What I do then is I just bring the VFO on the transmitter back down, and then I'll see this thing just to flicker that bulb just a little bit. And if you were to listen on the side tone, you'll hear it go boop, 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 and it sounds that boop, 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 meaning that it's actually wobbling back and forth with it. Just a very slight difference, but they're right on top of their center frequency. Now, you can buy an outboard gadget like this that they sell, I believe it's made by Pinewave, makes one. But basically, that's exactly what it is. You set the center frequency of your receiver on this gadget, and then you watch it. If you have a little bit of problem with tone deafness, or that they say the added dimension is that you're able to not only listen with your ear, but at the same time see it. You can see the three LEDs, how they act. If you get below the three LEDs and you see if you're a little bit higher or a little lower, you'll see the LED flicker. Nice little gadget that I think they had an article on how you can homebrew a simple system like that, Dick. In fact, I think it was recently in one of the magazines. Over.
Yeah, that was my next question, Mel. This beautiful circuit with the LEDs, is that a Mel Schneider original, or is that a Mel Schneider modification of somebody else's article? Over to you, Mel.
Well, I always plagiarize somebody's idea, you know. It's part of a unit. I happened to get the whole unit originally. I built one outboard, and somebody gave me a nice gadget because they were going to throw it out. They said, don't worry, they burnt it out. You know, another one of these things I salvaged out of garbage pail. And it's called the Pinewave 599. You add it to the receiver, and it gives you, you can bring the filter, my God, you can turn it down, way down, like 50 cycles with it. But it's got that indicator on the panel. Nice little box, I don't know what they sell for. But it duplicates just that circuit if you just want the tuning of CW. They have, you know, the circuit very simple. In fact, I can say it's been one of the magazines. I think they featured basically how to make such a gadget to add on to any rig for precise tuning of CW Dick Olin.
Very fine. Was that you, Andy, who had another suggestion? Who was the person with the other suggestion?
So it was me, Dick, RIT, to the receiver and sensor tuning 0 feet to transmitter and offset the receiver to where you like.
Okay. That's another good suggestion. The RIT function, you could put a pencil mark where if you set the RIT function at a particular point on the dial, it'll help you do zero beating. And one possible way would be to set the RIT in such a position that when you're directly on the guy's frequency, you'll hear a tone that goes to zero hertz or some other recognizable frequency on your rig. Is that sort of what you were suggesting there, Howie?
Absolutely.
Okay. So most of the really good rigs these days have an RIT, and so that's a handy way of using it. I think I've used up all the people who signed in who said they had a question, but maybe I've made a mistake along those lines, and maybe Bob had a question. So anyone else with a question or a comment, give us your call letters right now. My goodness, we used up the questions that fast tonight. Unusual. I wonder if Paul is with us. WS2N, are you there, Paul?
W2EWK, checking in.
Hi.
And K2JJ.
K2JJ and K2JJ. Eugene, we recognize you. Doug, did you have a comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, I just had a few comments on HARP, Dick, if we have time.
Yeah, thank you for that information about HARP. That is a potent transmitter. Why don't you take some time and describe the HARP experiment to us? We amateurs really get enthralled at the really potent transmitters. I think that thing is something like 50 kilowatts per tower, and 50-some-odd towers of all these individual antennas, something like 5 million watts of radiated power. Some huge number like that is the HARP transmitter, which is trying to create an artificial ionosphere, and it's doing a very good job of it. And it was just tonight, I was over my buddy's house, WB2QGZ, who played to me what the moonbound sounded like at his QTH in Massapequa, on a little bit below 7 megacycles. So 40-meter moonbound has taken place, and I've heard it with my own ears over a tape recording that was done on his rig. So, Doug, please tell us about HARP. Take your time and tell us all the gory details. K2LAW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Say good evening to everyone. I was pretty amazed myself when I looked up the all this information is on their website. If you just look up HARP, H-A-A-R-P, is an official website. The transmitter, I was pretty amazed by this. I did have a question. Consists of 180 72-foot towers, each of them with cross dipoles, one going east and west, one going north and south. Each tower being fed by a 20-kilowatt transmitter, okay, which gives us a transmitter power of 3.6 million watts. The whole antenna array, I believe they call it a planar array. They have these things phased together. They're steerable. The whole antenna array gives you a gain of, they claim, 31 dB. When we're looking at a transmit power now of 3.6 million watts with an antenna gain of 31 dB, you're looking at, something like, considering losses, I think 3,500 megawatts of ERP, Dick, if I did the math right. Pretty amazing.
That sounds about right. 180 individual elements of a phased array, doesn't give you anywhere near that number of dB of gain. However, the fact that each one of the elements, each one of the 180 towers, has an antenna with more than one element to it in front of a reflector, and the element itself is a dipole, and I think the gain they're talking about is gain over isotropic. So you add 2.14 for a dipole gain, you add some number of dB for the gain over dipole of each individual element of this array, which is the cross dipoles in front of a reflector, and then 180 of them. So they claim 31 dB of gain. I think they're in the right ballpark. I think they might be a half a dB high. And by way of adjusting the phase of the signal that's fed to each of those elements, you can steer that beam, electronic steering. And so in theory, they could follow the moon as the moon sweeps across their array. And so that gives them that amount of watts, close to 4 million watts, with 30 dB of gain. I'm going to round off the numbers. That would be 4 billion watts, 4 gigawatts of effective isotropic radiated power. And that's no small signal to sneeze at. Granted, at 40 meters, the quarter of a million miles between Earth and Moon is going to give you a significant amount of free space loss. Our 30 dB gain antenna, I don't know the exact numbers, but it probably has something in the vicinity of a 15-degree beam width. The Moon only encompasses a half a degree of beam width to a person standing on the Earth looking at the Moon. So you can easily calculate what area the Moon has, a quarter of a square degree, compared to the 225 square degrees of the 3 dB beam width of their antenna, if it's 15 degrees of beam width and as an L. And therefore, the ratio between those two tells you what percentage of the energy you're transmitting will strike the Moon. And of that energy that strikes the Moon tends to scatter it in essentially all directions, and a small amount of it comes back to the Earth, picked up by your G5RV, if that's what you're using to receive it with. So what you're going to receive is not going to be a potent signal, but it still can be reasonably far above threshold. That gives you a little bit of the geometry of what's going on. You probably have some more you wanted to tell us, or right ahead, Doug. K2JJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I did have a question, Dick. These towers, they're, they say 70-foot towers. The antennas are not mounted very high. They have one set of dipoles up about 33 feet, I think, and that's for the high band, and another set, the same identical cut for different frequencies on their so-called low band. All of this is done between... I think 3 and 12 megahertz, something like that. My question would be, how in the world do this is on a 30-acre site, these towers, these 180 towers, 20 kilowatts apiece. How in the world do they prevent one transmitter, one tower, from getting back into the other? You would think you would get a certain amount of RF back down the cable from tower to tower, but perhaps they're using isolators or something else. I wonder if you have an idea on that.
Yes, I do. Whenever you study phased arrays, and I've lived a small fraction of my life with them, particularly the ones that are on the B-1 bomber, they are an electronically steered antenna on essentially every one of the transmitters. One of the sad truths of life is that whenever you build a phased array, the elements always cross-couple. In other words, I may build an antenna that has 10 elements wide, 10 elements high, total of 100 elements. Every single one of those elements has a certain coupling coefficient to every one of the 99 other elements in the array of my particular example. They all cross-couple. A intelligent designer anticipates the amount of cross-coupling and compensates for it. If you simply use the circulator, you would only be absorbing the energy that went into the other element, and that would be kind of a waste. If you're one step smarter than that, you can recognize what percentage of the energy from each element is going to couple into the other elements. You can figure out what will be the phase angle of the resultant signal, both the one that you're transmitting and the one that got coupled into it, and therefore, when you're adjusting the phase of the transmitter for that element, you can compensate for all of that and make it come out right. So by readjusting the phase of the signal that you send to the element directly, you can make it come out right. If the final signal radiated by the element, due to both what your transmitter and the phasing harness is doing, plus what the cross coupling is doing, you put that all together, if each element has the right final phase, your beam-forming network will give you a beautiful pencil beam out there in space in the right direction. A naive operator of a, or a naive designer of a phased array, and I've met a few of those in my time, there's a lot more of them than the other kind, say that, yeah, there's going to be some cross-coupling, but it can't be very big, I'm not going to worry about it. Well, unless you've got extremely wide spacing of the elements, that cross-coupling can give you quite a bit of grief. It can show up as standing wave ratio to the transmitter, and it can show up as extra side lobes to the transmitter, and in the extreme case, it can actually show up as a an auxiliary beam steering network where the you want to steer the beam straight up, and it ends up at some other slightly different angle.